Tonight is the 65th anniversary of John Lee's passing, because he was the person who formulated the breath meditation method that we're pursuing right now. It's good to reflect on what kind of person he was. There's a jetty, 13-spired monument at Wadasukaram, one of the monasteries he founded. Inside there's a large room with statues of the different Ajahns. Each statue has a little phrase about what was distinctive about that Ajahn. I must admit, there's something wrong about distilling a person's whole life into one little phrase. In John Lee's case, the phrase is that he had high mental power. Palangchit Song. So in Thai, that usually means strong powers of concentration. And in John Lee's case, that's certainly true. The story is not only about the strength of his concentration, but also the various psychic powers that went along with his concentration. But there's a lot more to John Lee than just the power of his concentration. As John Fuang said, John Lee had a very large heart. It encompassed all kinds of people. In the year 1957, they did a celebration of the 2,500 years of Buddhism. A lot of young men ordained, and many of them stayed on for the rains retreat. And John Fuang, who was put in charge of training them, told John Lee that they're really difficult to train. As he put it in Thai, lua kha, which means the kind of things that are left over after everybody's taken what they want. John Lee's comment was, well, even if they can't grasp the Dharma, maybe a few grains of sand stick to their hands. That's still good. In other words, he wanted to give people what Dharma they could comprehend. And it was only a little bit, well, it's better than nothing. But to get back to the high mental power, in John Lee's case, it also meant that he was very intelligent. Of the various four Ajahns, he was the only one who wrote systematic treatises about the Dharma, laying things out very clearly, consistently. And had a lot of insight into the practice of concentration. Not only was his concentration strong, but he understood it really well. He solved a lot of the issues that we have in Theravada, about the relationship of mindfulness to concentration, what mindfulness is, what concentration is, meaning of some of the terms in the standard formula, as in the case of describing right mindfulness. He wrote a whole book on the topic, and as in most books on the topic, he focused first on dividing the material into being mindful of the body in and of itself, feelings, mind states, mental qualities. But throughout the book, the main emphasis is on the three qualities you bring to that process of establishing mindfulness on these four things. Mindfulness, alertness, ardency. And he defined his terms very much in line with the canon, not so much in line with the commentaries. Mindfulness, for example, means keeping something in mind. Alertness means knowing what you're doing while you're doing it, and seeing the results of what you're doing. And ardency is the desire to do this well. Now in the commentaries, they define that quality of alertness more as clear comprehension, and for them that's the wisdom quality. We see things in terms of the three characteristics, see things in context. The problem is the commentary gets very snide about defining alertness as seeing, knowing what you're doing while you're doing it, even though that's clearly what the canon says. And John Lee saw that the wisdom quality there was in the ardency. You don't just watch things as they are. You see things as they function, and you try to make them function in the best way they can. Not so much things as they are as things as they can be. And the desire to do this well is the source of wisdom. as you said, desire is not all bad. When you see that you have ignorance, the desire to get past that ignorance is a good thing. Why are we meditating here? If it weren't for the desire, we wouldn't be here. So skillful desire is wise. It's also wise in the sense that you can read about the Buddhist teachings and you can talk about them. But if you don't have the desire to put them into practice and actually master them as skills, you can't be said to be wise. That was another one of his insights, is that the practice of meditation is like a skill. He compared it to making a pair of pants, making clay tiles, making objects out of silver. You learn by working with what you've got, trying to make something good out of what you've got. With the cloth, you try to make a pair of pants. If you have straw or vines, you try to weave a basket. And then after you've done that, you look at what you've done. And you evaluate what you've done. This is where we get into his explanation of concentration. For him, the line between mindfulness and concentration is really very, very vague. The purpose of mindfulness is to get you into concentration. When you get into concentration, the factors for the first jhana, directed thought, evaluation, singleness of preoccupation, pleasure, rapture, and the ardency that gets you from the practice of mindfulness into the practice of concentration, and gets embodied in the evaluation, that together with the alertness. And here the Chan Li has a really good explanation for evaluation in this state of concentration. Another one of the big issues in Theravada meditation practice, which is often widely misunderstood. You use your powers of observation to see what you're doing, and then figure out how to do it better. That's what you're evaluating. How can you get the mind and the breath to stay together? Remember when I first learned his method of meditation? I found it really liberating. I've been meditating in a way where you're supposed to stay focused just on one spot, tip of the nose. You're supposed to breathe, let the breath do whatever it was going to do. You're not supposed to manipulate the breath in any way. I found myself getting headaches and feeling confined. Reading a John Lee, we encourage you to play with the breath, experiment with the breath, try to see which kind of breathing feels best, and then to spread that comfortable breath and along with your sense of awareness throughout the whole body. I found it liberating. At the same time, you're learning how to use your powers of observation and develop your powers of judgment. Often people complain, how do I know what kind of breathing is better than another kind of breathing? Well, you just do it, and then you observe. If you don't trust your own powers of observation, you want somebody else to explain it for you. You're never going to get anywhere. You have to evaluate for yourself what feels best right now. If you're not really sure, well, you take a stab. Just stick with one way of breathing for a while. And after all, you begin to realize, okay, this feels really good, or else this doesn't feel right at all. Then you can change. Ask yourself, well, if it's not right, what felt not right? Were you putting too much effort into the in-breath, too much effort into the out-breath? Well, reduce the amount of effort. You're not here to force the breath. When the Chan Li talks about experimenting with the length of the breath, or the spreading the breath energy throughout the body. He uses a Thai word that basically means allow. Allow these things to change, see what happens. And this way you get the most out of the breath as an object of concentration. Because it feels good to be here. Instead of thinking about the task of concentrating, you think about the opportunity to enjoy the way you breathe. And to let that breath fill the whole body. Of the various forces of Chan, John Lee is the one who speaks the most about whole body awareness, in line with the canon. The images in the canon of the bathman mixing the water with the flower, of the cool spring at the bottom of a lake, filling the whole lake with its cool waters. The advantage of this is that it feels really good to be here, and your concentration gets really solidly based. If it's based just on one point, If you move from that one point, the concentration has been lost. But if the framework for your concentration is the whole body, then what may come in, go out, doesn't have to disturb your frame. That way your mindfulness is established, your concentration is established. So these are just some of the issues that Ajahn Lee was able to clear up, bring in line with the canon, based on his own experience. That's when you know the practice is going well. When what you experience, when you check it against the canon, you begin to say, oh yes, that's right. I didn't understand that passage in the canon before because I hadn't developed the skill yet. But now that I've developed the skill, I know what the Buddha's talking about. In my own case, when I first started meditating, we didn't have many sutras around. What translations there were old and stodgy. What I had was basically Ajahn Lee, Keeping the Breath in Mind, book of his Dharma talks, his book on mindfulness. I followed that. Then years later, as I came across the suttas, especially Majjhima 140, Majjhima 121, they talk about being observant of your meditation. Everything fit together. We do have this idealized vision of the Forest of Jhans, just going out and practicing without any formal practice, without any formal training. That's not the case. They got a good training in Vinaya. And those like Ajahn Lee who were really curious did read in the texts. Ajahn Phuong tells how when they would have their evening meditation at one of the monasteries that Ajahn Lee founded, where Ajahn Phuong was number two in command, they would have a meditation session in the evening that lasted from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., chanting, followed by meditation, sometimes a reading. And once a month, a magazine would come from Bangkok. It was called Dhammacakshu, the Dhamma Eye. It was about articles on the Dhamma, translations from the suttas. At that point, the Pali Canon was being translated for the first time, the whole canon into Thai. And on the day when that magazine came, then that night, that was what was read aloud to everybody, the whole magazine. So Ajahn Lee did study, passed the basic exams, what they call the Dhamma experts, which is a pretty basic knowledge, but then he also kept studying on throughout his life. As he said, he wanted to be a storehouse to expand his knowledge so he could be a better teacher. But still, it's pretty amazing that someone with a very basic education was able to deal with the large issues in Theravada meditation, clear them up, based both on his experience, both on the skills that he developed and on the texts. That was another aspect of his high mental power. Not just the power of his concentration, but the power of his discernment. His discernment was subtle and all around, very circumspect. As we practice this method, those are the qualities we want to bring to our own practice as well. Subtle, observant, circumspect. So we carry on this tradition not only in name, but we can fully embody it.